From New York City, the world-famous Comedy Cellar presents Live from America Podcast. Live from America Podcast. With Noam Dorman and Hatem Gabber. Live from America Podcast. Where the top experts in the world and the best comics in the nation get together weekly to discuss today's issues as they cover news, culture, politics, comedy, and more with an equal part of knowledge and comedy. And now, here are your hosts, Hatem Gabber and Noam Dorman.
Hey, welcome to Live from America Podcast. This is Hatem. Noam Dorman, the owner of the Comedy Cellar, will be here shortly. Juanita Dorman, also owner of the Comedy Cellar. She just logged out for some reason, technology people. they're very funny and very smart. My good friend, comedian Nick Griffin. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here. Great to meet you, Amanda. I'm excited.
Long time
nice
no see.
You too.
Yeah. Nick holds the record for The Tonight Show. He's the most comedian that ever been in The Tonight Show. He's there like every
It was Letterman. I did it a bunch
Letterman,
of times.
Letterman, I'm sorry. Yeah.
There's some other people that are a little longer, but over that period, I did pretty well. The 4 or 5 years I was, or 10 years I was getting on.
Memorable backstage anecdotes?
You know, there was one interesting one where after the show, I was waiting for the, it's an old theater, and I was waiting for the elevator, and it was slow, so I started to go up the stairs just to walk up the stairs, and a bunch of the people said, no, that's where Dave is, you can't go up there. So I freaked out and ran down, like, you know, my parents were scolding me.
There you go. And our guest of honor, Amanda Knox, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You live in another planet, Amanda Knox is an exoneree. She's a journalist, public speaker, author of the New York Times bestseller, Waiting to be Heard. Between 2007 and 2015, she spent nearly 4 years in an Italian prison and 8 years on a trial for murder she did not commit. She has since become an advocate for criminal justice reform and media ethics. So good to have you.
Yeah, thank you. And that was a mouthful. Wow, thank you very much.
and welcome to your 250 million interview.
Have you listened to them all?
No, but I don't know how you do it.
I mean, you know, people ask, and I always think that I have learned.
What's that? There's some.
Do you hear me now?
Did we lose you, Hatem?
No, did you?
No, oh. I hear everyone.
Yeah, I hear you.
Did you guys hear music?
No.
Okay. My mistake. There's something was happening. I don't know what's going on. I think what's his name? The Italian prosecutor is trying to to hack into this show. Get away, man.
I don't know if he's got that technological capability.
It's so good to have you. And, you know, hopefully we're going to get you in New York to come and watch a couple of real Comedy Cellar shows.
Oh, I would love that. I'm a huge comedy fan, actually. It's interesting that my life has been such a bummer in relation. But I suppose every good comedian starts with a bummer story and just flips it. Is that how that works?
Yeah.
That's pretty accurate. Yeah. Wow. Okay. Wow. You got a future ahead of you.
I'm a student of the arts.
I always hear like all my comedian friends say, like, you know, comedy a lot comes from pain, you know? Right, Nick?
Well, I think it's, you know, it's like any human being, whatever sticks with you in your mind, and then you have to sit down and finally write something down, it's going to be that stuff that's just stuck in your mind for the last 20 years or 15 years or 10 years or the big events, you know, and that's certainly where I go.
That's awesome. Like, so you take something that haunts you and then you try to find the absurdity in it and then use misdirection to get people to feel a certain way and then zing them with a comic comedic comment.
Yes, that's
exactly.
One way of saying it, tell a joke. Yeah.
Amanda, are you sure you're not a comedian? Because you kind of...
Well, I haven't said a joke yet.
So, listen, I want to start this like in a different way. Of course, everybody want to discuss the story, want to talk about the story. But for me, I take this a little personally, not only what happened to you, but in general situation like this. I want to talk about like right now, your work, because I think what defines you is what you're doing right now. Everything happened, shaped you, but people are going to still try to keep you in that, you know. But I think all the good work that when people like hear what you do, I don't think they hear it enough. They just hear the name and stuck to that story. So I want to talk about what you're doing right now. So let's start with that.
Oh my gosh. I am both very shocked and very appreciative that you have that that perspective, because that's been the sort of long time journey, is grappling with the fact that, wow, am I just going to be forever defined by something I didn't do? And there's like nothing I could possibly do in my life that could be as meaningful and impactful as just some crazy ass thing that happened to me. So I really appreciate that. And a lot of my work today has been like the result of grappling with that question. So to be clear, me and my husband have a production company called Knox Robinson Productions. We have a podcast called Labyrinths, but we also produce a lot of really cool work that's in the works that I can hint at but can't quite say. My husband's a novelist. I'm working on another book, and it's all, again, deriving from that sense of what does it feel like when you are thrust into a situation out of your control? How do you grapple with the crisis of that, the trauma of that? How do you integrate that into your own life, into your own sense of identity? How do you move forward instead of getting stuck in your past? All of that is what my work sort of comes back to. And I do that by thinking about what happened to me, but also helping other people think about their own experiences and find their own voice.
That's excellent. I mean, we'll open the floor, guys. Feel free, because we all like, I have a million questions. Feel free to ask any question at any turn, you know. It doesn't matter. But do you still like worry about, like, at this point, about even proving anything to anybody?
Oh, no. I mean, even during the whole process, it felt like in the dark side of it, like it didn't really matter what the truth was to a lot of people. So it didn't really feel like even proving my innocence would matter. Like when that conviction came down the first time, like, you're guilty, you're sentenced to 26 years in prison, like you're a murderer. That was an existential crisis of having my entire life rewritten, my identity being taken over by this fantasy version of me, Foxy Noxie, that existed in the public's imagination. And what it ultimately made me feel like was that I didn't matter. And what that's the dark side of it. But the bright side of it is that all of that hatred and all of that, you know, prosecutorial effort was directed at a person who doesn't exist. And so it's really easy for me to not take it personally when people continue to insist on the fantasy that I had something to do with this horrific crime that I absolutely had nothing to do with.
So. How long after it came down that you were arrested and everything, did it take you to kind of galvanize? I mean, it must have just obviously been shocking. That's an understatement, but how long did it take you to really kind of gather yourself and say, okay, this is where I'm at now. I need to get to this other place and get through this? Or was it a series of ups and downs? And
yeah. So one thing to note is I was 20 when all of this happened. So I was a kid.
Crazy.
Yeah.
I was 20 and I was a kid and I did not have a lot of life experience. You know, I was already grappling with this like incomprehensible nightmare of coming home and finding my friend murdered. And then on top of that, being thrown in a prison cell by a bunch of strangers who had no idea who I was. And they were accusing me of heinous things. Like there was a lot that I had to process. And it
and you weren't speaking the language either.
And I didn't speak the language. So
crazy.
So it took a long time for me to even understand the gravity of the situation. And I think that that is something that people who have been through trauma can deal with, because, or can understand, because when you're thrust into a traumatic situation, oftentimes your mind tries to compensate by thinking, no, it's certainly not that bad. Like, no, certainly it's not the worst case scenario. And you try to come up with reasons for how what's happening to you is not as bad as it really is. So for the first like year of my imprisonment, I was like, oh, this is all just a big misunderstanding. The adults are going to come in the room and fix this. And what I didn't realize for a long time was that, no, there were no adults in the room. Everyone, or at least the adults in the room, were not behaving like the adults that I thought that they were supposed to be. They were being human, which is to say they were being flawed, and they were imagining that they were right, and they had to prove that they were right. And they were more interested in that than they were in finding out what the truth was. I spent a long time in prison, really, really plagued by the question of why. Like, why was this happening to me? Why didn't they believe me? Especially when it was very, very clear very early on who actually committed this crime, right? Like, this wasn't like a lot of wrongful conviction cases where they misdirect and they go towards someone else, and then... But then like later on, years later, they find the DNA and it turns out that it was a completely different person that was not on anybody's radar. Like my case, they, within weeks, they knew who actually committed this crime, but they had already arrested me in the meantime. And so instead of releasing me and saying, oops, they said, oh, we're still convinced that we're right to have arrested her. And so we're going to try to find ways to make sure that that remains the case. And so I struggled with that why question for a long time. And it ultimately came down to having to put myself in the shoes of the people who were doing this to me. Like, how could people who think they're doing the right thing be doing this to me? And it was because I genuinely believed that no one was sitting around in their like police office going, ha ha ha, how am I going to wrongfully convict a young woman today? Right. Like, that's not how people work. They convince right. themselves they're doing the right thing. And so then the question became why? And there's a long, complicated answer to that. But
it was more than that too. Like they created a story, you know, the mm-hmm. sex game thing was certain, yeah. you know, like,
oh, yeah.
which I understand because it sells more, you know, it's better.
The thing about Amanda's story, which is so crazy and fascinating at the same time, is that they convicted this young 20-year-old based on the way that she was behaving on the time of the murder, not on any based on all circumstantial evidence, nothing proving that she committed this crime. That is what's so crazy about this case. And things like this happen a lot. It yes. happens a lot, especially in the U.S., in New York, especially. I mean, the majority of people who are put on trial, they plead guilty because they don't want to go through the trial.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's
thank you for bringing that up. That is a very important point.
It really is. And this happens a lot to people, young people within the, I think, ages of 18 and 24. Mm-hmm. I remember when I first started to get a clue on this was when one of the first cases that I was addicted to, like follow this case, was the West Memphis Three. They had these three teenage boys who were convicted of killing these younger boys. And at the time, I had just given birth to my son, Nicholas. And I was like, this is crazy. And they had no evidence on these kids either. And they spent over, I think, almost 20 years in prison trying to prove their innocence.
Yeah, Damien on death row.
That's right, and never got exonerated. Mm-hmm. So I do follow a lot of these cases, especially when it involves young people, because a lot of them don't have the maturity or have the tools or know what to do in this kind of scenario.
Yeah, notably, you know, I'm so glad you noted the age range here as well, because we're talking about people who are legally defined as adults. Anyone who's over 18 is legally defined as an adult. And yet they're all people who are under 25. So under the age which our brains are totally fully developed as adults. And that is that crucial age range where young people find themselves, if they're innocent but accused of crimes, find themselves in situations that are totally overwhelming and beyond their control. And you're right. So many of them don't even go to the trial phase and try to prove their innocence because they feel like they have no resources and ability to combat the state. And so they just say, okay, I'll say I did it. I don't have a fully like full understanding as an 18-year-old what those lifelong consequences are going to be, but also they're making what ultimately amounts to a rational choice because, you know, the prosecutors will tell you, if I take you to trial right now, I'm going to get, you know, life without parole for you.
That's right.
So you know what? Right. How about we just work together on this? You spend a, you know, just a paltry 20 years in prison and you'll get out and have the rest of your life. And like so many people make that choice every day. And so many of them never get exonerated ever.
That's right. That's right. So, and then there's also a case, and this kind of happened to you, I think that you were kind of coerced into a confession in the beginning. Within your first, and this happens a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, they have these young people, they're sitting there for hours, they have no idea what's going on. And by the end, they're convinced that they actually committed this crime. They actually, even if they're not, if they didn't convince themselves, they're done with the interrogation. They want to admit to the crime just to get out of whatever they're into at that moment.
Yep. You know? And they hope that the evidence will prove them innocent because they're like, there's no way in hell they're going to find me guilty of something that I didn't do. Yeah, no, it's absolutely true. And what I think is fascinating about false confessions, I think it's one of those things that flies against our intuitions. Like you wouldn't do something that wouldn't be in your self-interest, but we see people doing plea bargains and it's rational to think that that could be a choice that's in your self-interest because you're thinking, well, better 20 years than a life without parole. But people are making that same calculation in the interrogation room when the police are telling them, look, you either confess or we're going to nail you to the wall. Or they are saying, well, maybe you're so traumatized, like they did with me. They said, maybe you're so traumatized by what you witnessed that you don't even remember it. So let us tell you what happened. And if you really want to stick on the side of justice and be on the good guys, you're going to go with it. And you feel like you don't have a choice in that situation. And those interrogation systems are designed to make you feel like you don't have a choice. So, one other fun fact about false confessions is people think that maybe you'd be more likely to confess to when you're being accused of a lesser crime. But in fact, it's when the crimes are more severe, like you're being accused of murder, that you find people more often falsely confessing because they're terrified of what the consequences would be if they don't just do what the police tell them to do.
Right. So, that was a lot.
Yeah, but, sorry. You know, I'm kind of a bummer sometimes.
No, I mean, what I like about this conversation is that I have four kids aging from the ages of 28 to 4. And, you know, my son's a minority and I say to my, and we really have to teach our children how to behave in public, what to say, what's the right and wrong thing, because everybody is watching you, especially now. I mean, more than ever now, we have social media. Everyone's taping every little thing you do and posting it. All kinds of craziness, you know?
Yeah. It's just I mean, what's even scarier is when someone wants to make you look guilty, it doesn't really matter how you behave because they will find a way to make you look guilty. They'll find the one picture of you that's you're in the background of someone else's picture looking askance in a weird way. And people be like, that's the photo that we're going to use to blow up in the media sphere to make him look guilty. Like that's like, I think one of the really scary aspects is that when you think about how bias works into all of this, like whether it's conscious or unconscious, like people are crafting stories about the people that they see and encounter, and especially in these high stakes scenarios, and they'll create a monster out of any regular person. And they have done it and will continue to do it as long as we don't like put some safeguards up.
Because it's a business, you know, journalism, everything. Like there's obviously some good people, but also the fact that it turned, instead of you know, the murder of Meredith, it becomes your case, you know, it becomes Amanda Knox, not even, you know, which is insulting to the family, obviously, and the victim. Nick, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I wanted to go back a little bit and ask Amanda why or what you think the motivation is for, I mean, I believe that these people are, you know, pushing, trying to get wrong confessions from people, but what do you think? Is it just to get their plate clean? Is it just to get it off the docket? I mean, why are they obviously, maybe they're crooked. Is it just fast?
I mean, there's a lot that goes into that, right? And it obviously depends person to person. There Sure. have been absolutely cases of people who were wildly corrupt, who just flagrantly, intentionally were putting innocent people in prison and torturing them. Like, Chicago has a long history of that.
Yeah.
That's not how wrongful convictions occur. And if we only focus on those specific instances, we're going to overlook the majority of wrongful convictions cases that are worth our attention. Because usually what is happening is that, I mean, first of all, we're all socially embedded people, right? We all are making decisions about who we are and what our role in the world and how we're going to react to each other based upon our roles and the people that we're interacting with and the systems and structures that we are embedded in. And so one thing to look at when we're seeing people making bad choices, especially those who are in positions of power, is how the institutions that they are embedded in are incentivizing them to make those choices. Is it that they don't want to expend a ton of resources to investigate a case? And so it's just much easier to get someone to confess. It doesn't take that much resources. You don't have to have people on the street interviewing people and trying to get information. You just get one person in a room for hours on end, get them to confess, call it a day, next case. So there is a problem of resources and incentive structures and people getting sort of elected or rising in the ranks of police offices and prosecutors' offices for their conviction rates, not for their conviction right. integrity. And then there's, you know, the public push, the public perception of who is committing crimes and why and how we should deal with the fact that people are committing crimes. Is it that just there are bad people and good people and bad people should get locked away for the rest of their life for as long as possible? Or is it possible that even they are socially embedded creatures who are being incentivized by the structure of society to make self-interested choices potentially at the expense of others?
And I think also the ego of detect, like sometimes they will walk in and they have a theory. And now it's not like, let's look at other theories. No, I want to prove that this theory, find a way to make this. And it's a little bit off topic, but, you know, obviously with torture, like we saw in Guantanamo Bay and stuff like that, they torture some terror and they say, okay, we did it. And they end up bombing places that civilians, you know, so eventually like lack of sleep, like it's not like it's going to make you like, you know what, fuck it, I'm going to do that. I'm not saying it's the same thing, but I'm saying just, you know, you can get confession out of anybody, even with a horrible, horrible crime, you know, so, you know.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Just the part with you dealing with all this and moving on. And so I heard that you you spoke to Monica Lewinsky about this. Is that true?
Oh, yeah. She is a good friend of mine. Yeah, I first met Monica actually when I was first asked to give a public talk. And that was a very terrifying experience for me because my experience of being asked to speak about my story was very much one of hostility. You know, I'm thinking the interrogation room. I'm thinking the courtroom. I'm thinking Diane Sawyer, who's like, did you or did you not murder Meredith? It's just like everyone was so hostile towards me. And the idea of telling my story felt like I was opening myself up to yet more hostility. But someone convinced me that I was walking into a room full of people who really just wanted to learn from other people's experiences and be better people and live better lives. And so that was the audience. It was not an audience that was there to, quote, put me on trial. all the same, I was really scared, and I was, you know, just paranoid about it. But one of the things that convinced me was learning that Monica was also going to be speaking at this event. It was an event that was geared towards the theme of controversy. And what does controversy mean? How is it created? What do people who find themselves at the centers of controversies do about it? How do you move on from controversy? And I agreed and asked to be able to speak with her beforehand. By that point, Monica had already written her Vanity Fair article, was already, you know, had already done her TED talk, and really was like the only model that I knew of someone who had been so completely and utterly vilified and dehumanized and like thrown away, like exploited and then thrown away as trash, and who had successfully rebuilt her life. And she was the only model that I could think of. And so meeting her and feeling her friendship and compassion and receiving her guidance. And most of it was just saying like, hey, take care of yourself. You know, like there's a million ways that the world is being demanding of people like us. And they're in the habit of exploiting us and vilifying us and seeing us in the worst possible light. And they're going to continue feeling that way, feeling entitled to do that. So take care of yourself. And I really appreciated that.
Yeah, I think it's amazing how you guys can actually picked up, moved on, and built a life for yourself, because many people wouldn't, you know, that's just a hard thing to recover from.
It is.
Know? Yeah.
I mean, that was going to be my next question. Like you had two choices. One is just like kind of to disappear and be like not in the public eye. And one is to fight and become an activist. And why did you choose that?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. It didn't really feel like a choice. in the sense that like we're all called to do something, and it doesn't really feel like a choice when you genuinely feel called to do something. It just feels like waking up in the morning and taking your first breath. But on the other hand, it was true that like, it's not like I came back to the world from prison and trial and it was a blank slate for me. I thought I was going to get to go back to a life where I was just an anonymous student again, studying languages. And that world, I discovered very sadly, did not exist for me anymore. There were paparazzi staked out outside of my house. I couldn't go to school without being followed. I couldn't go to the grocery store without being followed. And so that added this other further level of trauma and realization that like not only was the world a very different place, but also I was a different person. I had a lot of processing to do to integrate what this experience meant to me and how I could then decide what to do with that information. And what I found myself feeling was compelled to point out whenever I saw people who were being scapegoated for the sake of an ideology or an idea or someone else's reputation. Like it felt like people, especially in the social media age, are plucked out of anonymous existence, splattered with a sort of headline, and then exploited until they disappear. And what is the actual consequence of that? That and feeling like you don't get to be the author of your own story. Like how many times are people's stories stolen from them before they even had a chance to know what their story was? Yeah. I mean, I think that's one of the really tragic things about true crime is like, if you're a victim of a crime or the criminal justice system, either way, you're just walking along one day and the worst experience of your life suddenly falls in your lap. And before you have a chance to even process what it means to you, other people are defining what your story is, who you are, what it means, and you feel powerless to reclaim that for yourself. And it's something that I deeply, deeply feel. And whenever people reach out to me to say that, like, in their own small or big ways, they're going through something like that, I try to help them reestablish a sense of presence with themselves and a sense of ownership over their own story.
That's kind of what your podcast is also about, right?
Exactly. Yeah. It's, you know, the the tagline is getting lost with Amanda Knox, but the idea is that we're all lost sometimes. We're all, first of all, we all have a worst experience of our lives, one. So all of us are having to reintegrate that experience into who we are and what that means about the world and our perspective of it and how we want to move forward instead of be trapped in the past of that horrible experience. And I like to talk to people who are at various stages of that journey. Some people are right at the very beginning and don't know what to do. And I try to help them feel like there is a path. Other people are in the middle of it and they're not sure if they're going in the right direction. And I try to help them recalibrate where they are. And other people just have a crazy story that they've somehow managed to survive just like me. And I'm happy to talk to them about it, especially because we also move on. We also continue to be people despite the big story that happened to us or the big thing that happened to us. So feeling like you're not the victim of someone else's story, or worse, the villain of someone else's story, but the author of your own story is something that I feel is totally within reach of anyone at any time. And at the same time feels so, so out of reach for so many people.
There was an episode in your podcast with model Emilia Wilson.
Yeah.
Who played you. Yeah. So she's a friend of mine. So she, she told me, I'm going to do this podcast, listen to me. And I listen, and it's you and her. She played you in cover. If you want to tell the story, because.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I love her. I'm so glad you're friends with her, because I was so impressed by her. The courage that she had and like the integrity that she showed. So the story is, as a young model, young struggling model, sometimes we get pulled into modeling situations that are not ideal. Sometimes, that happens all the time. That's almost a trope now, that like models end up doing shoots that make them feel totally uncomfortable and that haunt them for years afterwards. And in Emily's case, the one thing that she had done that had haunted her the most was when she was asked to pose as me. And the me character, the Foxy Noxy character, was presented in an incredibly flippant and honestly offensive way, not just to me, because, it showed me like the me character, like in my underwear doing yoga behind bars, but like also, holding a butcher knife with like blood everywhere.
Bloody, yeah.
And like, this is like, you're referring to Meredith's murder. That's, that ketchup that you've just splattered everywhere for your photo op was that's representing Meredith's blood. And so this whole like series of photos that she did for Vice haunted her for years. And one day she decided to reach out to me to apologize. And she
That's very big
out
of
to
her.
Me. It's yeah. so big of her.
And I think also it's great from you that you actually not just accept, like, you had her as a guest in your podcast as well, and you managed to discuss it. So, I mean,
it was amazing. I recommend everyone listen to the episode because she's awesome. And I always love the courage of someone who has like is holding themselves accountable, but also like, she deserved to cut herself some slack, because we're all socially embedded. There are bigger things at play. She's not the only one responsible for that photo series. In fact, she's the least responsible, but she's the face of it. And she wanted to take responsibility and talk about it. And I give her so much credit for that.
I mean, but how can you fight the media and win? This is kind of like, how can you fight that? They can say and do a post, whatever they want, and people take it as if, it's the word of God.
It's so true. It's like... Yeah, it's true. And I think one of the big traps is feeling like you have to rewrite someone else's story that's already in progress, right? The media picks up a story, they pick up a way to tell a story, and they go with it because they know that it's going to pick up the most attention and the most clicks and
Right.
And I can't say that I am a complete success story in this regard, because people still know me as the girl who was accused of murder. But what I will say is I've learned that reacting to that narrative is a losing game. Instead, you have to, again, like, start your own story, tell your own story through your actions and through your work and through your ideas, and allowing yourself to, like, just move in a different direction that doesn't force you to be shackled to some shit show that you had nothing to do with. Okay. So really, like, having the presence of mind to know that, like, you don't have to participate in someone else's shit show.
And I wanted to kind of ask that question, but in a different way. Like, what do you consider victory? Like, obviously you had a lot, like, you won the case, you proved, you did your documentary, but even when you save someone with your work right now, I mean, that's when you inspire somebody like that. That's, but what do you consider victory in general for you? Like, because you said, I think before, you know, it's funny. I was watching a documentary of yours, and I wasn't really watching because I don't like to get, like, people's their views, because whoever's making the documentary either can make it evil with music and lights, or can make it, you know. But I like to read the comments, you know. That's my favorite thing, is not even watch a thing, just leave. And the people are so opposite. And what's funny is, like, sometimes you can see where the comments has been, you know, most of them didn't even watch the whole thing. They're just putting their whatever they think, and it's like, hey. So for you, what do you think it's victory? What do you consider, like, okay, I won this?
I mean, that's changed over time, but I think that for me today, I mean, just this past weekend, I gave a talk in Nantucket, and someone who follows my podcast Labyrinths drove out from upstate New York, drove all the way down, took the ferry over to Nantucket just to finally, like, meet me in person and hear me talk, and basically sat down and let me know that I was the reason why he was still alive today, because at a certain point, he was going through a very, very traumatic experience in his life, and he was thinking about committing suicide. And then he stumbled upon my podcast, and he told me that, like, just week by week, I helped him navigate his life until the next week. And I didn't even know. And to, like, know that, like, I, when I was going through my whole experience, I felt so incredibly isolated. I thought, like, I was the only person that this was ever happening to, or even if I wasn't, when was I ever going to meet another person who was going through something like this, or who would understand how I felt? And there have been moments in my, since I've been released and exonerated, that I've had those just shocking encounters of connection. So, like, for instance, the first time I went to the Innocence Network conference, for those who don't know, there's an annual get together every year of all of these innocence projects that are spread out across the United States, but also around the world. And they gather together all of these attorneys and scientists, but also wrongfully convicted people. And the first time I went, I hadn't been fully exonerated, so I didn't even know if I belonged there. The last thing that I wanted to do was walk into a room full of hundreds of strangers who would recognize me. But my mom insisted, so she drove me down and, you know, pushed me into the conference room. And immediately these two men ran up to me and gave me this huge hug. And they just said, "You don't have to worry about a thing, little sister. We know." And each of them had spent over a decade each in prison for crimes they didn't commit. And they knew exactly how I felt. And that feeling of just feeling understood instead of judged, and feeling like I could be present instead of trapped in my past, was the most overwhelming feeling of relief that I have ever felt. And I have just wanted to pass that on and help people discover that feeling for themselves, because you don't even have to encounter others to find that feeling. It's just a lot. It's a fast way to get there.
Right. But they're still trying to rewrite your story. Even now today, I watched this movie Stillwater on Sunday. And I was like, right after I watched it, I was like, oh my God, this is totally Amanda's story. But from, they tried to do it from a different point of view, but I was like, oh my God, is there a lawsuit going on? Like, what is going on that you
should Did they ever consult with you on any point?
This is
crazy. No. In fact, I wrote an Atlantic article about this, because this is not the first time that Hollywood has, and also, you know, production companies abroad have said, okay, it's the Amanda Knox story, but in France, or the Amanda Knox story, but if she became a lawyer, or this episode of Law and Order is the, you know, Trixie Dixie, you know, case, like whatever, you know, and it's just like, God. And it's because it's amazing. The Stillwater one was really interesting because they, first of all, used my name to advertise this show, this movie. And they were like, you know, patting themselves on the back for having gone out to Oklahoma to really meet the people that they were going to represent in the film and the kinds of people who are living the hard life in Oklahoma. But meanwhile, like no one ever considered to reach out to me. And it was just like, because I'm not a real person in a lot of people's minds. I am an idea of a person. I am a premise for a story that sells papers and movies and books. And it's, I think people, one, don't really want to deal with the idea of asking my consent, because then it becomes a moral issue. I think it draws into question what they're morally doing with the worst experience of my life and other people's lives as well.
But if they reached out to you, would you have consented? I mean,
it depends. I would have had a conversation with them and asked them what kind of story they wanted to tell, because I think that there, in all lived experiences, there are worthy stories to tell. And then there are just stories that are boring or harmful or cliche and are easy. And I think that what was unfortunate is Stillwater told a very easy and
it was easy,
ultimately harmful story, because it reinforced those same sort of fantasies about the Foxy Noxy character, but didn't take responsibility for them, because they were like, oh, it's not Amanda. Her name's not Amanda. So it doesn't matter.
Now, I think one of the important parts of the end of that movie, the daughter kind of confesses that she knew the killer knew that he was going to. So it kind of really brings back to the question of what people ask today. Did you know this guy, the killer, you know,
did I know something? Could I have done something about it?
And it brings that all back.
Directly involved. And it's all that pernicious narrative. And it's the reputational cost that it caused to me. And people just keep putting that out there without a second thought. I did reach out, like I, in my Atlantic article piece, I was like, look, you know, maybe you made a mistake. Maybe you just didn't consider, you know, talking to me in the process. You know what? A lot of people make that mistake, but here I am, want to talk about it, and no response.
Yeah.
During the imprisonment and the trial and all that, how did you, because you were we were talking about the media earlier, how did you feel like the American media did with the whole situation? Do you feel like they had your back, or were...
Well, to tell the truth, at the time, I didn't have access to American media. I was an Italian prison cell, and we didn't get CNN. So I only heard about what was going on in American media and media abroad through, you know, my friends and family. And of course, there were people in the U.S. who started asking important questions, particularly once the trial phase came about, which was over a year into my imprisonment. They were like, okay, we've heard about this big, amazing story about the girl next door who's actually a murderer. Let's see the evidence. Dun-da-da. Wait, where is it?
And there's no evidence.
And there is no evidence. And so people were like, wait a second. And so there were some people like that. But also, I think there were people here in the U.S. even who made their careers on presenting the story as student killer Amanda Knox.
Yeah.
So it's not, I can't paint, you know, the American media or the British media or the Italian media with the same brush.
It's sad because the media has no moral compass, you know. It's just about, you know, how many viewers they can get. You know, it's crazy.
Yeah, and it's interesting because journalism is an incredibly powerful and important tool that we have
and
all
noble.
it's noble, right? Like there have been really incredible ways that the media has swooped in to hold power, especially accountable to the people. And what's weird is that instead of doing that in my case or in the cases of so many wrongfully convicted people, they've said, well, there are certain kinds of people we're accountable to, and then there, and those are our the people who are going to click on our headlines. And so we're going to deliver to them what they want to hear, which is a crazy story that just keeps getting crazier and crazier. Whether that's true or not doesn't seem to be super important. And that's, again, how we're all sort of socially embedded and incentivizing each other. If the audience, I mean, it's this horrible snake eating its tail kind of thing, because on the one hand, certain media out there tricks people into thinking that they're hearing, you know, God's honest truth. And it's, oh my goodness, can you believe it? And then it turns out that no, they were wrong and people feel betrayed by that media. But at the same time, there are people who find like it's natural to feel drawn to stories that are extreme and surprising and engaging because there are all these twists and turns. And so the media tries to craft reality, like squeeze reality through that lens for the sake of its audience. And I think that says something about how we can be more, when I say I'm trying to advocate for media literacy, in part that's as consumers, like what kind of media are we asking for by what we click on and what we engage with, that and what we pay for. That's a big factor in all of this.
You think you got more coverage, media coverage, when you were, when they thought that you were guilty or when you got innocent?
Hard to say. I was in the jail cell the whole time. So I don't really have a great global perspective of it. Also because I have frankly not, you know, gone back to look at all the footage. Yeah. I haven't.
Have you been back to Italy?
Would you go?
Oh, you have?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's crazy.
Yeah. I've been twice. The first time, most importantly, was because the Italy Innocence Project, which did not exist when I was imprisoned, they came into existence and wanted to hold this conference to like talk about wrongful convictions in Italy. And they invited me to be the keynote speaker to talk about trial by media and how there's this, again, this like snake eating its tail, vicious cycle between media and the courtroom, where each are trying to appease and satisfy the other. And it ends up spiraling out of control. And so I went there. I gave a speech. I was terrified.
Were you okay? Did you feel?
So the really sweet ending to this story is like, so I go in and of course, the second I step off the airplane, you know, the TSA agents like, look who's here. And then as soon as I walk out of the building, like I'm swarmed by paparazzi, and that does not stop the entire time I'm there. Like people literally tripping over themselves to shove cameras in my face and yell questions at me, and they do not let up. I arrive at this conference. I'm not the only speaker there. I have friends who are there to talk about really important issues like, you know, the death penalty. And as soon as I sit down in the audience to try to be a good participant and supporter of my friends, like paparazzi literally shine a spotlight on me in the middle of a darkened auditorium so that they can take pictures of me listening to somebody. And then when it finally comes my turn to give my talk, they have to give a 45-minute preface explaining why they even invited me here, because it's such a controversial choice in Italy. And then I get up, I spill my guts out, I tell my story, I talk about the media, I talk about my prosecutor, I try to give everyone involved a fair shake, the fair shake that I didn't get. And at the end of it, I had no idea how anyone was going to react, if they were going to boo, if they were going to throw things at me, if they were going to be completely silent. I got a standing ovation and I was sort of whisked off stage by this, you know, security guard who took me down these winding steps into the basement where I had been hiding. And at the bottom of the, like, I was sort of in shock. And at the bottom of the stairs, before he let me go, he just sort of gave me a little squeeze. Aww. And he said, perfetto. And it was just, ugh.
I'm glad you chose the only word we know in Italian.
I know.
If you say anything else, I have no idea what you said. Are you in touch with any of the other characters in that back in the incident?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I'm still in touch with Raffaele.
Yeah.
So for those who don't know, Raffaele was my co-defendant. The only reason that he got roped into this whole thing was because he was my alibi. He was my boyfriend as of 5 days before we were arrested. And he was put through hell, spent, you know, years.
But 5 days when you're 20, it's like a lifetime. So.
Yeah, right, yeah. Right. But like 5 days, like, okay, we just are super into each other, but you know.
Yeah. right.
He didn't have to, like, you know, get run over for me. He could have just said, you know what, I don't want to, you know, like, how many times have people saved their own skins just because they didn't want to deal with their, sure, their life at risk? And yeah, he stuck by me and professed his innocence and my innocence and spent just as long in prison and just as long on trial as me.
Wow.
He's had a harder time starting his life over because he is still in Italy.
Yeah.
And he faces a lot of prejudice, a lot of overt hostility.
But he didn't have as many documentaries about him.
Or he's kind of like, well, and that's a really good point, right? Why is it that there is so much focus on me and not him when he's just as innocent? And also, why isn't there as much focus on the person who actually committed this crime?
Yeah, I mean, like, I think the answer is easy. The way you look, you know, you're pretty, and that's what sold from the beginning. If you saw that picture in the newspaper, oh my God, you know, so and that just shows you, because if it was fair, it would have been all of them. What about the guy? He just got released, right?
Rudy Gaudet.
Yeah, last
the guy
year
who actually committed this crime.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was released in 2020. And
how you feel about that?
I have a whole episode of my podcast where I talk about it because it's complicated. But so people,
which one
can
is
go
it? So people can know.
The Forgotten Killer is what it's called.
Okay.
Oh.
So
if you're listening to this, turn this off now. Turn this podcast off now. And
I'll give the short version, which is that I am a firm believer, having sort of immersed myself in the criminal justice reform community, but also having lived alongside actually guilty people for years of my developmental life and come to know them and appreciate them as human beings, that everyone is more than the worst thing they ever did, right? Like, everyone is. Everyone is more than the best thing they ever did and the worst thing they ever did. Everyone is more than the worst thing that's ever happened to them. And so while I am trying to be fair to him and appreciate that a lot of time has passed and he may have grown as a human being, and also, you know, I don't believe that someone who is that young and that stupid should spend the rest of their life in prison. Like, you know, like, there are a million ways that I will concede this is a person who deserves a second chance. The part where I struggle is how, at no point along this whole journey did the legal system find him fully accountable for his crimes.
That's what I was going to say. He was never convicted of murder.
He was. So
he was convicted of murder.
I thought rape.
So in Italy, the way that it works is if you are considered participant or part of a conspiracy to commit murder, they say you are just as guilty of the murder. But he was never actually found guilty of having committed the violent act, right? Like, they say that he was primarily responsible for Meredith's rape, but that he was not the one who was holding the knife. And he was like that. When he was arrested, he had cuts on his hand. Like, why are we debating this question? And yet, like, that was not what he was convicted of. And so that's why he received a lesser sentence, also in part because he decided to do an abbreviated trial. And
but he also never confessed to the crime. He never admitted to. He still actually blames you for the crime.
Exactly. Yes.
So
yeah. So the fact that he not just refuses to take responsibility and hold himself accountable, but he also continues to push that blame onto me and onto Raffaele is difficult for me to accept. But
But so how could you forgive somebody like that? Why would you give someone like that a second chance? I mean,
oh, well, the question of whether or not you give someone a second chance to be a human being in the world is a different question than whether or not you forgive them. And I think the first question has to do with, do they pose a threat to others? And, you know, is it possible that now that this person is in his 30s and he has lived, you know, a life, a very disciplined life, and he has structure to his life that he didn't have before, that he is less of a threat to others? I think that's likely. I mean, a lot of research bears that out, that the kind of violent impulsiveness that someone might do in their 20s is not going to present as likely when they're in their 40s or 50s or whatever that is. So that may be the case. And I hope to God that
crazy to me. He raped someone. He stabbed her over 40 times.
It's true. It's true. And it's a shame that he was never held fully accountable for that.
And he doesn't admit to it. He doesn't take any responsibility for it. This is not somebody who's rehabilitated.
I would agree. I would agree with that. But the question of forgiveness is another question. So when I think about what happened to me, none of what would have happened to me would have happened if Rudy Gadet hadn't murdered Meredith. But he's not the reason I was wrongly convicted. That has to do with another set of people's bad choices and bad decision making.
But it didn't help you. That's for sure.
No. None of this would have happened if
I think his first taped conversation with one of his friends, he actually says that you were not there. You had nothing to do with it. Then a couple of days later, there's another taped conversation where he's reading all the stuff from the media and starts to believe himself that you did it or you were there.
He's looking for a scapegoat.
It's just so crazy. So all of his confessions had changed over time.
Yeah, no, I'm not arguing with you that he's has despicable qualities.
Yeah, but then also he's a young kid. And I also feel like maybe his lawyer advised him to do that during his trial.
Absolutely.
Help him get a lesser sentence.
That's absolutely true. But when it comes to like the question of forgiveness, I think that forgiveness is less of an outward directed experience and it's more of an inward one. Like, are you going to continue to hold anger and resentment towards a person who you can't control? And that is an experience of suffering that you can either choose to hold on to or you can choose to let go. And the act of the forgiveness is the letting it go so that you no longer have to carry that anger and resentment and bitterness. Because holding on to something like that, everyone is entitled to it. We are all entitled to that kind of feeling. But what I have noticed is that it does not make me a better person. And it does not, I don't think it makes anybody a better person.
So are you saying you're not angry with him anymore? You've let this all go. He's in the past.
Well, I experience anger and I try to cut myself some slack for experiencing anger. Especially because I don't think we really choose what we experience. I think that feelings happen to us. The only thing that we can do is choose whether to sit and hold on to that feeling or let it go. And so when I notice myself feeling angry, I have been in the bad habit of holding on to it. And what that turns into is me crying in my closet. And when I let it go, that turns into me helping my daughter learn how to have her first steps. And I would much rather be doing the latter than the former.
Yeah. All right. Let's have one last question each. And we'll be done. Nick, you want to go first?
Well, she actually just kind of answered it. My question was, with all the experience, including her podcasting and Innocence Project and her own, you know, bad experience in Italy, not just herself, but having had conversations with other people, what does get you to the other side of it? And it seemed like, you know, there was some talk of faith there or.
Oh, actually, I use the word God, but I'm not a, I don't, I'm an atheist. That was a metaphor.
No, me too. I kind of do the same.
Yeah, no, I'm actually really unusual because most wrongfully convicted people I know are faith people, are spiritual people, and
for the most part,
religious people. Yeah, it's fairly common. Also because a lot of times the only, I mean, a lot of people have that cultural background, but also within the prison environment, very often there aren't like emotional mental health support. Like that's usually just coming from a prison chaplain. And, you know, like one of my best friends in prison, my best friend in prison was the prison chaplain. We had a lot of fun intellectual debates. But for me, the way that I get through it, not being a person who is spiritual, not having faith that some higher power has a plan for me that's going to make sense of all my experience. And like, I put that responsibility on myself to make sense of my experience. And the best thing that I can think of, and it's like these little mental tricks that you play, they're just mental tricks, right? They don't say anything about the reality. But like one of the things that I sometimes imagine is that actually, instead of thinking of myself as incredibly unlucky, I think of myself as incredibly lucky. Like, what if what was going to happen to me that night was I was going to go home and I was going to be home with Meredith and we both ended up getting killed? And this version of my life is the lucky version. If there's an alternate reality version of me that is dead, and then there's this version of me that's still alive and I'm the lucky version. Like, that's just a mental experiment. It doesn't mean that I believe that that's true, but it helps me find gratitude in my experience. I'm grateful to be alive. I'm grateful to know things about the criminal justice system that I had no idea before. I had just no idea. And I feel like I can navigate the world as a more informed, better person who's not going to be unintentionally harming others the way I might have if I had just sort of gone around thinking good people stay out of prison and bad people go to prison. It's that simple, you know, like what did I know? And right. I feel better for what I know now.
Juanita?
Well, you know, unfortunately, this one incident defined your life and your life path, right? You're now an advocate for people who are going through the same kind of things. But on another note, is there anything you want people to know about you that other than this incident, like anything you want the world to know? I mean, you're a human being. You're just like everybody else. Is there something else you want everyone else to know about you?
She's a mom.
I am a mom.
We know she's a mom.
I think the thing that I, a part of myself that the world doesn't really get to see very often because I am so often, I wouldn't even say pigeonholed, because it's a good thing to go out there and talk about like criminal justice reform and really, you know, like trauma, like all those things are things that I'm constantly asked to talk about. But a huge part of me is having a sense of humor. I am like at the end of a long day of podcasting, like Weird Al is my go-to, and I will belt out Lonely Island like no other. Like I love comedy. I love music. I love getting dressed up in costume and going to Ren Faire. Like I love to play. I'm a very playful person. And I don't think people expect that from me because I'm always seen in such a sober light. So
I was actually going to tell you that. I was like, I think you are very funny, but I think you're very careful about what you say because you don't want to take it the wrong way. But I think if we get you like a couple of drinks here or there and just hang out,
and get me in front of that backdrop, and
I'm sure Nick and the other guys can help you get some really good punchlines out of this trauma.
I would love that. You know, I would love that. For sure. Please follow you know, up with me.
Listen, I told you about the cellar talks. You know, I'd love to have you. You know, come and do a talk. It'll be like even just for us. You know, nobody else.
Yeah,
like,
I'll practice my material on you.
You don't have to get on stage. Most of the time, we just sit around the comedy table and just shoot the shit, and it's just funny.
I love that.
So Amanda, during this whole time, all the million interviews and all this, is there one question that nobody ever asked you? And he said, like in your mind, is like, why nobody asked me this? Like during the whole time.
One thing that I notice when I, especially when I go and do public speaking, but I've also noticed this in my interviews, is a huge part of my life today is my husband and my family. And, you know, when my husband met me, I was working for minimum wage in a local bookstore that was literally underground. I was hiding. I felt like no one would ever give me a chance to be a real person. Everyone would view me in the worst possible light. I didn't know if I could make friends with real people in the world, like a normal person. And he came along and befriended me and did not, you know, Google me the minute he met me. And he was the one who convinced me that my voice mattered. And that I wasn't just a survivor of an experience, but I was someone who had something to offer. And so I wouldn't be sitting here in front of you today if it weren't for my husband, who has encouraged me and supported me from the moment I met him. He's lovely. Cool. He's also a host on our podcast and a producer. He's a lot of fun.
Juanita, won't you wish that you can say the same thing?
Yeah, I have no voice. My husband doesn't want me to talk. I'm not allowed to say anything. I say all the politically incorrect things. It's
perfect.
Just, yeah.
Well, Amanda, this was great. Thank you so much for being here and for the chat. I think, you know, I like that we talk more about you than anything else. And it really, like, I think people could see, and I really want the next time we're going to have you, like today, I didn't want to do a lot of comedy, but you know, the next time we're going to have a lot of like, yeah. And whenever you come to New York. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. All right. Let's do it.
Do you want to tell a joke?
Visit us in New York.
Oh God. No, I want you guys to help me work on my punchlines. Cause the one joke that I really like is that people really should be friends with me, because if they're ever like, if ever, anything ever goes down, I'm going to be the first one who's accused. anyone can be friends with me because they're off the hook. Everyone's get out of jail free card. So.
Yeah. We should all sit at the table and be like, she did it.
Exactly.
I think if you ever want to change your career to a comedian, I think you have it. You already have a lot of things. I'm sure you have.
Don't do it. It's miserable.
I think it'd be nice to at least just hang out with a bunch of comedians
Amanda, you want to share your information where people can find you, your podcast and
podcast is called Labyrinths. My book is called Waiting to Be Heard. You can find me on Twitter at Amanda Knox, on Instagram at Amama Knox, and all my collection of work is at knoxrobinson.com.
Nick, you want to share information?
Oh, you can follow me on Instagram at Comic Nick Griffin. And then just you can go to my website, nickgriffin.net. That's where all my videos and stuff, information.
Juanita, comedyseller.com, I guess.
Yes, Juanita, one of the owners at the comedyseller.com.
And you did have some shows for Project Innocent. When that is going to come back? Remember? You did have shows, right?
There's so many of those that I follow, and it's so obsessive. One of them is Adnan Saeed that I follow a lot, this young boy who was 18, and
I'm saying you had shows at the Comedy Cellar and you donated for Project Innocent. You were working,
before COVID.
Yeah.
And then COVID kind of screwed everything up. We were donating shows to the Innocent Projects and, you know, other charities of that source. And yeah, we'd like to pick that up again, but we haven't been able to.
Yeah.
We're kind of short staffed, so adding shows is kind of hard.
All right. Totally. Well, the Comedy Cellar, next, you never know who you're going to see, you know, Chappelle, Chris Rock, Amanda Knox on the stage, you know, doing some jokes. You never know. You know what? I'm going to convince you. You'll see. We'll be friends now. I'm going to make you do comedy.
All right. I love it.
All right, guys. Thank you so much. It was great.